happy Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. I am your host, Michael Cutler. It's always great to join you at the end of the week, play that inevitable game of catch-up that we seem to do. Today is September the 18th, 2015. So much going on, more chaos every time you turn the television on. But here we are, and we'll try to sort all the lunacy out. And boy, oh boy, there is no shortage of madness or issues that we need to discuss. But for those of you who are new to my program, I thank you for tuning in. I am a retired senior special agent with what used to be the Immigration and Naturalization Service, the old INS, which was sliced, diced, and ripped to shreds, if you will, when they created that Frankenstein creation that I've come to call the Department of Homeland Surrender, the DHS. They split immigration into several components, made it as unwieldy as possible, because let's be honest, folks, both political parties have no intention of securing our borders in reality or enforcing our laws in a way that would be effective. I want you to contrast what America is doing with what Europe is doing now that this stampede, if you will, of refugees and others is now underway. What a contrast. We are supposed to be the superpowers, and it seems as though we have the Keystone Cops in charge of national security. And I'm not talking about the Border Patrol agents or the field agents. No, those people, those men and women are dedicated to the mission, are desperate to be allowed to do their jobs. It's the clown car of the U.S. Congress. It's this administration. But we will get to that shortly. But first, I want to remind everybody about the websites I would very much like for you to go visit. My own personal website, michaelcutler.net, C-U-T-L-E-R, michaelcutler.net. Of course, if you're familiar with me, you know for many years I've been proud to write for a terrific organization out on the West Coast, Californians for Population Stabilization. A mouthful of words, the easiest way to remember them is CAPS. CAPS, and their website, appropriately enough, capsweb.org. I have also become a columnist for Front Page Magazine. That's been ongoing for almost a year now. Proud to be able to contribute to their website, their publication. I write for Progressives for Immigration Reform, and as their name implies, they lean to the left. This is not a left-right issue, folks. This is a right-wrong issue, and the summer edition of The Social Contract has a major article. I was the lead article in their quarterly journal, and I wrote about the nexus between immigration, national security, and where we are now 14 years after those god-awful terrorist attacks of September 11, 2001. Hard to believe it has been so many years. And it's hard to believe that our government, this administration, is acting in direct opposition to the findings and recommendations of the 9/11 Commission, to which I provided testimony. And you'd be hard-pressed to find too many Republicans who get it or who want to get it, and we'd like to give it to them too, whatever it is. But goodness, you cannot protect a country when you have millions of people from all over the world living in towns and cities in this far-flung nation. And the notion of, as Dr. Ben Carson talked about, that we're going to simply register them would help us. It's a prescription for a disaster, and Ben Carson should know better. But I thought it would be appropriate to use the term prescription since he is a surgeon, or at least is a retired surgeon. Again, I thank you for being with me this evening. But I want you to know also, by the way, off the top, I want you to know that my program is called the Michael Cutler Hour, and for quite some time I've been doing a 90-minute program because I'm always faced with the problem of trying to put 10 pounds of stuff into a 5-pound bag, but I will adhere to that time limit, at least for the foreseeable future. Cowboy Logic Radio has asked if I would adhere to that hour-long format. If I would be willing to do that, they would be willing to post my podcasts of this program on their radio program so we could piggyback, and I've agreed to do it. You know, ever since the attacks of 9/11, my mission, as they would say, Mission Impossible, Mr. Phelps, has been to educate as many of our fellow Americans and as many of our alleged leaders in politics about the true significance of immigration, border security, and the need to protect the American people. This coming Sunday, I'm going to be traveling down to Spartanburg, South Carolina, because the administration is attempting to send them a bunch of refugees. And so, you know, right off the top, and I'm going down there to try to provide a dose of reality to what this is about. And again, if you're familiar with me, familiar with the program, you know my background. I am Jewish. I was named for my grandmother, who was killed in the Holocaust because of our religion. I'm usually a very big fan of political asylum and refugee programs to help people who are at risk. But the world is a dangerous place. And if you look at the articles that are out there, and I just wrote an article for Front Page Magazine, if you go there, I think you'll find it interesting. I posted it on the website that's connected to my radio program. But the title of my article is "The Refugee Crisis Must Not Undermine U.S. National Security. America's enemies must not be permitted to turn our compassion into a weapon to use against us." We have no idea who is present in the United States today. We have no idea who is coming here claiming to be refugees. And this morning I was awakened to a Fox News report that a British reporter, had found out that he could purchase, believe it or not, a passport for $2,000 along with other supporting documents. This is insanity. It was the Daily Mail, and the reporter said this: "Passport to terror, male online reporter by Syrian papers being sold to ISIS fighters sneaking into Europe hidden among the refugees." The reporter's name, Nick Fagge, F-A-G-G-E. I guess I'm pronouncing it properly. The article dated yesterday, September the 17th. So this is a very real threat. And if you consider what the 9/11 Commission talked about, and that's why I keep coming back to the 9/11 Commission. And yet when you start to talk about the 9/11 Commission to the mainstream media, and I don't care which TV network we're talking about, although I'm on a phone conversation with their producers, you could see their eyes rolling to the back of their head as soon as I say, let's put this into the context of the 9/11 Commission. And as soon as you raise the issue of the 9/11 Commission, you may as well be talking about Area 51. I kid you not. I kid you not. And I find this astonishing. You know, when airplanes crash, the first thing that happens is the NTSB, National Transportation Safety Board, the FAA, and the airline come out to see what happened. Why did an airliner filled with passengers suddenly become a smoking hole in the ground? Did the control tower screw up? Was it pilot error? Was it weather and outside the purview that anybody could have foreseen? Was there a maintenance issue? Did somebody not secure parts of the airplane properly? Is there a design flaw? Is there a combination of factors? They want to know what happened. They want to know if it's a terrorist act. Did a bomb bring it down? Was the plane hijacked? They go through all the possibilities. Because the obvious goal of the investigators, first and foremost, is to try to make certain it never happens again. Never again, right? When Space Shuttle Challenger blew up, the government, NASA, commissioned a report. They established a commission to look into why Challenger disintegrated. They eventually found that the O-rings, coupled with the cold temperature of that morning launch back in 1986 in the winter, did Challenger in. When Space Shuttle Columbia disintegrated in the skies over Columbia, same deal. They immediately launched an investigation. What do we need to do to make certain this doesn't happen again? And they came to realize there were problems with the heat shield, with the wing, with the foam coming off of the external tank, the oxygen tank. So everybody understood what the problem was, and they started, let's fix this. Let's fix this. Because they don't want it to happen again. That was the reason for the 9/11 Commission report. I provided testimony to the 9/11 Commission. And they talked about immigration fraud and visa fraud. They talked about political asylum programs, how the primary method of entry was not for the terrorists, was not the Mexican border. That's what everybody wants to talk about. The border, the border, the border, the border. I wrote an article for Front Page Magazine several months ago I called it border security and the immigration colander. And I said that when people talk about securing the border, they are in essence talking about plugging, and not even completely. If you look at the language, it's unbelievable. 90% operational control of a high traffic areas within a period of 6 years, and then we'll review it, and we'll find out what the weather report is, and maybe we need to take umbrella. I mean, it's amazing. Instead of simply saying, we will secure the border. When the soldiers landed at Normandy on D-Day, Operation Overlord, created by the brilliance of our generals, executed exquisitely by some of the most courageous Americans and Allied soldiers in creation, who know they were walking into their death trap, the Nazi death trap, and they did it. They went knowing they would probably not see sunset that night to protect America, to protect our liberty, to protect our freedom. Put yourself in the head of some 20-year-old kid weighted down with ammunition and his gun, knowing he was going to walk into a hailstorm of bullets. And they did it. They did it exquisitely. And no one said, well, we'll see if we can get somewhere here. And give us 6 or 7 years and maybe we'll. No. They were given the order to do it, and they did it, and that was it. And by the end of the day, the casualty count was horrific. But damn it, this is what people do that are committed to a cause. We're fighting terrorists. We're fighting criminals. We're fighting the war on drugs. We have sanctuary cities undermining not only public safety. The Stiley murder was horrific. But let's be blunt. If she wasn't such a gorgeous young lady with such an incredible future ahead of her, nobody would have paid attention. And I know that they wouldn't have, because on that same day, I promise you, there were other people killed by people who had no right to be in the United States. This is happening each and every day, and nobody reports on it. Not a word, not a peep, not a sound. No one's shooting up any flares and saying anything about it. But suddenly, there was this incredibly beautiful young woman with everything to live for, getting cut down by a piece of slime, some crap that crawled out of a sewer, was deported 5 times previously, did felonies inside the United States. This guy doesn't deserve to breathe air. And yet he was back again, and he was cut loose intentionally by San Francisco. Yeah, take a stroll, go take a walk. We know you're a dirtbag, who cares? And he winds up killing a young woman who had everything to live for. So that made the headlines. But folks, this has been going on for decades. America's mayor, Rudy Giuliani, maintained the sanctuary policies that he found when he became the mayor. And I wound up testifying at the murder trial of a piece of garbage by the name of Ronaldo Rayside, a Panamanian drug dealer, who I had physically deported. I put this piece of human detritus on an airplane because he was ordered deported by an immigration judge. And why was he ordered deported? Was he being singled out and treated disparately? No. He actually had a green card, and he lost it because of a bunch of criminal convictions involving drugs and violence. I put him on an airplane. I executed that warrant of deportation. I made certain that the plane disappeared into the sky, and only then did I go back with the detention officer that I was working with that day and take care of whatever else I had to take care of. But because of Rudy Giuliani's sanctuary policies, when the police arrested him, the NYPD arrested this bucket of slime, not once but twice 2 years afterwards, their hands were tied. They were handcuffed by America's mayor, who said in the policies, you will not contact immigration, period. We don't care. You will not call immigration. If you do, there'll be hell to pay. So the third time he's encountered by Robert Machete, a 24-year-old police officer. He goes for Machete's gun, bullets fly, and I wind up testifying at the murder trial. Machete's wife was pregnant with a little girl who he would never meet. And by accident, by weird circumstance, I met her when she was working as a checkout clerk in a supermarket not far from my home. I testified at that murder trial. That family was never the same. And that happened almost 30 years ago. This has been going on forever, forever. Ronald Reagan gave us the first amnesty. I know there are some conservatives who think that Ronald Reagan, you know, walks on water. He gave us the first amnesty, refused to hire more agents, allowed the position of immigration commissioner to go vacant for quite some time, and then wanted to give the job to a political fundraiser, a contributor, who owned some Cadillac dealerships in Florida. That's what Ronald Reagan thought of immigration. Jimmy Carter thought of immigration as a way to get votes by manipulating the census, by ordering immigration agents to not make any arrests during the census. We were told, you will not make arrests or else. And somebody did, and this guy was almost suspended. And he said, well, the guy has a criminal history. They said, we don't care. You needed to go through headquarters, and they had to okay it. And why was this done? Because Jimmy Carter, the peanut farmer, wanted to make damn certain that the illegal aliens, of course, we had to call them undocumented workers, that foolishness, that Orwellian newspeak came right out of the imagination of Mr. Carter. But the whole idea was that if they counted the illegals in the United States, and yes, they are illegal, and if I'm upsetting you, good for you, take some heartburn medicine, because they are illegal aliens. That is the law. That is the language used in the law, by the way, as well, and we're going to get to the use of language soon. Because he wanted them counted. Because the apportionment of the seats in the United States Congress and in the Electoral College are determined by the census. So if you have big population centers that tend to vote for Democrats, and you wind up with lots more people being counted when they redistrict the Congress, you're going to wind up with more seats in the liberal strongholds. And I say this to you as a Democrat. See, I don't care about party because the parties both suck. We have the Democrats and the repugnant cans, and that's why the outsiders are doing so well in the presidential campaign. Donald Trump, Carly Fiorina, Dr. Ben Carson. Why are they doing so well? Because we wish we were Donald Trump and could say to the Congress, you're fired. There's a couple of exceptions. There are. Jeff Sessions should be the next president. That's my number one pick. I've never met a politician with more courage, who's more forthright, who's willing to stare down his own political leaders and stick his thumb right in their eye and stare them in the face when he does it. This guy has the biggest, fattest, strongest spine of anybody I've ever met. And, you know, I wrote a commentary for the Washington Times back in 2007 when they first tried to foist comprehensive reform on us. I had testified before three House hearings, one Senate hearing, and I wrote a commentary, and I started out talking about the loss of the two space shuttles, and I compared the hearings with the countdown for the launch of the space shuttle, where the experts decide whether or not it's safe to go forward with the launch. The purpose for the congressional hearings was for the experts to say whether it was intelligent and reasonable to go forward with proposed legislation. And the idea of giving millions of people who snuck into the United States, who have absolutely less than zero claim to being allowed to stay here. They are trespassers, okay? To give them identity documents, and we're dealing with people whose identities cannot be verified, whose dates of entry cannot be verified, whose intentions for coming here cannot be determined, whose potential affiliation with criminal or terrorist organizations cannot be determined, and to give all these millions of people identity documents, which means, by the way, because of the daunting number, that there will be no capacity to do an in-person interview or a field investigation, is an act of national suicide. And I recommended that they rename comprehensive immigration reform and give it the name that I came up with, which is the Terrorist Assistance and Facilitation Act. Well, Senator Sessions liked what I said so much that he quoted me from the floor of the Senate with attribution. Unlike so many dirtbags in politics who plagiarize, he said, Mike Cutler, former INS senior special agent, said the following, and then sent me a certificate commemorating that. My good friend Lou Barletta has often used phrases that I've used, and almost always with attribution. This is about character. I've dealt with some politicians who were very eager to take what I wrote and take words that other people wrote, believe it was their own, which in my mind is theft of intellectual property. Character is what's lacking from our leaders today, and I don't think anybody out there will disagree with me. So for Jeff Sessions to stand on the floor of the United States Senate on three separate days, and I will tell you, one of the 9/11 family members, my friend Bruce Dussel, a former New York City cop whose son-in-law was obliterated on 9/11, he was in his 20s, young kid, they found his remains scattered over southern Manhattan, over lower Manhattan. Called me up during that hearing. He said, "Mike, quick, put your TV on, go to C-SPAN." I said, "Bruce, I'm on the phone. I'm in my car. I can only talk to you on the phone. I don't have access to a TV." So he took his telephone and held it next to the TV so I could hear what the senator had to say. And it blew me away. It blew me away that by accident I happened to run into a recording, a YouTube recording of Lou Barletta during a congressional hearing quoting me with attribution. And it's not that I need my name out there. I don't care. I really don't. This isn't about me. It's about them. It's about them. Steve King did the same thing. And he didn't call me up and say, "Guess what I did, Mike? Somebody sent me a link to a YouTube video of Steve King, congressman from Iowa, holding a press conference on the steps of the Capitol, and he quoted me with attribution." And then you've got politicians who are too small, who are too whatever you want to think of them, to give credit to anybody who says anything. You know, this is where we're going wrong. We have wound up with this privileged ruling elite who just see us as impediments to what they want. They will manipulate the vote, and they do, you know, on election day, and they do it by creating illusions that they're doing what we want. They spend a ton of taxpayer money, and then, I hate to say this, folks, too many of the conservatives, I hear this more from their side than the other side, and we should have these conversations. That's what the First Amendment is about. Oh, we hate those civil servants. Boy, those lazy bums who work for the government, they can't accomplish anything, are barking up the wrong tree. You know, this is the narrative. The civil servants are a bunch of lazy bums. I've worked with federal agents from a bunch of other agencies. I work with police officers. They're government workers. They are some of the finest human beings I have ever met, some of the most courageous, some of the most straightforward, gutsy, and moral people you would ever have the privilege of knowing or serving with. They put in hours like you won't believe, and we did not get extra pay for it. After you've worked 10 hours as a federal agent, everything else is thank you so much. I've had work days where I worked side by side with agents from the FBI, DEA, my own agency, the INS. We worked 30, 35, sometimes 40 hours, nonstop, and got 2 days' pay for it. So it just infuriates me when I hear this nonsense about the lazy civil servants. It's the politicians who make certain that they rig the game so that we can't succeed. There was a study done that said that drones on the border are ineffective. I was on with Neil Cavuto a couple years ago talking about the drones on the border. But you see, most people don't understand. They think drones, they think military. We need military on the border. They're giving us drones. Wow, now we're getting serious. Those drones are not armed, nor should they be. Nor should they be. But there is a solution. Put up more helicopters with more Border Patrol agents on board. If a Border Patrol agent is overwhelmed, he finds himself surrounded by 30 illegal aliens, and this happens. And if they turn on him and he's getting attacked, they're throwing rocks, they're punching him, whatever's happening out there, it's a violent border. I've been there a bunch of times, to our leaders. I've been there, and I know Border Patrol agents. Do you want, if you were that agent, a drone overhead taking high-definition photographs, so God forbid if you wind up paralyzed or dead, your family will see exactly what happened to you? Or do you want a chopper with armed agents on board who can land and back you up? The answer is pretty obvious. And it's not a cost thing at all, folks, because I've spoken to Border Patrol pilots, and they've told me that for the cost of one drone, we could put up four helicopters with armed agents on board. It takes 17 people to run one drone. And the GAO found the same thing. Do you know how many arrests have been made by the use of drones? Zero. No arrests. And the report attacked the use of drones on the border. You know, maybe once in a while it makes sense. A real dangerous terrain, the weather is really lousy, you don't want to risk the lives of the pilots, send up a drone so we have constant coverage. I agree with that. There's a time and place. But the way we're doing it, it prevents the job from being done, which is what the goal is. And so what did the government do after the report came out? They bought more drones. They bought more drones. Why? because the job is not to secure the border, but to create the illusion. We know drugs and criminals and terrorists likely are pouring across the southern border. We need 7 years to figure out how to put up a border. That's almost as long as it took us to go to the moon. Folks, this is an absurdity. This is my dog ate my homework stupidity. And we are accepting this and saying, well, what are you going to do? And everyone promised to secure the border. But what we need to do is enforce the immigration laws from within the interior of the United States. That's really the way to get the job done. When Governor Christie says, well, when these people overstay the visa, someone's got to tap them on the shoulder and say, excuse me, you've overstayed. No, someone needs to arrest them. And I used to arrest them, and so did my colleagues at the INS. This isn't to tap them on the shoulder and remind them. They know they overstayed. They know they're here. Okay? You need to have the agents to arrest them. But it's a good soundbite. Ben Carson said, hey, you know what? We'll give them 6 months, and then we'll let these people register. And we need farm workers. We probably don't have 11 million illegal aliens in the United States, ladies and gentlemen. We probably have 30 or 40 million. And I'll tell you how I know this. Because Ronald Reagan sold us on this idea of the amnesty of 86, part of the Immigration Reform and Control Act, by saying, well, we've got about a million illegals in the country. We've got to get them out of the shadows. So we'll do it. One time, it'll never happen again. The 1 million grew into nearly 4 million. We're being told 11 to 12 million. Multiply it by 4, do the math, and here we are. And I do believe it's an accurate number. That 11 to 12 million figure hasn't moved, and the people that lie through their teeth, many of them journalists supposedly, oh, there's nobody crossing the Mexican border. Talk to the Border Patrol agents and ask them what's going on. Oh, if anything, the Mexicans are all leaving. Yeah, right. They're stampeding back to Mexico every day. It's lie after lie because corporations want the money. They don't care who dies. It's collateral damage. We are more concerned with civilian casualties in the Middle East. Our military spends a ton of money on smart bombs, in part to minimize what's known as collateral damage. Collateral damage means casualties of people who are non-combatants. I wrote about that, by the way, for capsweb.org. I wish you'd go to their website. They do a great job. And I wrote about this notion that we are obsessed with no civilian casualties in the theater of war, but the fact that we have casualties across America each and every day by aliens who are here in violation of our law, it doesn't even get a yawn. It doesn't get anything. Nobody wants to talk about it. Nobody wants to consider it. It's false. And now we're being told about all these refugees heading our way. And we know that, yes, some of these people are in a desperate situation. And you know what? I wish that I had a magic wand so I could separate the honest from the dishonest, the true refugees from the ISIS fighters who are seeing in this an opportunity. I can't. And you know, people will say to people, there's got to be a way to figure out who's here and when they got here. And the answer is no. Sometimes, much as we want to be able to do something, we can't. I lost family members to cancer. And unfortunately, I know many of you, we all suffer losses in life. Life isn't easy. And that's why when people screw things up for people intentionally, it's unforgivable. Because life by itself will do all kinds of damage, whether it's illness, whether it's accidents, terrible things happen. And I'm sure that many of you can relate to that terrible conversation with a doctor who gives you some really bad news about somebody who could not be more important to you in your life, and you say, well, there's got to be something you can do. And sometimes the doctor can't even make eye contact. Sometimes they stare at the floor, and in a barely audible voice, they mumble, I wish we could do something. When we're dealing with people flooding across borders, coming from a part of the world where terrorists are running rampant, where blood is flowing in the streets, we're running a very real risk that those terrorists who have promised to come to America and fly the flag of ISIS over the White House will see in this chaos opportunity. The Tsarnaev brothers, who carried out that deadly attack in Boston at the Marathon April 15th, 2013, were granted political asylum. And if you want to know how inept we are, because this is what this is about, whether or not we are capable of sorting out what's going on, they were granted political asylum. Now, in order to get political asylum, you have to make a case for credible fear. If I go back to my home country because of my race, my religion, my ethnicity, sexual orientation, whatever, I will face persecution or perhaps worse. Perhaps worse. And under those circumstances, because we are a compassionate country, we say, sure, we will grant you political asylum. Welcome to America. The Tsarnaev family did just that. They entered the United States through ports of entry. They didn't run the Mexican border that we keep hearing about. And as soon as we gave them lawful status, they proved to us they lied. Now, you wonder, probably, how did they prove that they lied? Well, if they got political asylum because they claimed credible fear, and they were from Russia, and there was no regime change in Russia, and they immediately got on airplanes and voluntarily flew to Russia, what do you think that's indicative of? It's indicative of the great likelihood that they lied about credible fear because they went back. They said they couldn't without facing dire consequences. Now, what did the United States do? Nothing. Nothing. And what's even more astonishing, and you may not know this, but more than a year after the attack at the Marathon during that summer of 2014, their sister gets arrested, the Tsarnaev brother's sister gets arrested for threatening to blow up her boyfriend. It seems that this is a family tradition, planting bombs and blowing up people or whatever. Delightful family. I'm certainly glad they don't live next door to me. But she's arrested by the police for making that threat. Why in the world was she at liberty to float around the United States more than a year after her brothers carried out a deadly terrorist attack? Don't you think someone at the Department of Homeland Surrender should have said, let's reel in this family because apparently they lied on their applications for asylum? That's a felony. It's no less a felony than lying on your tax returns. When I was with Senator Jeff Sessions and Congressman Louis Gohmert, John Fleming, and some other folks in Florida last November, I was there for a restoration weekend with the David Horowitz Freedom Center. And again, I'm very proud to be affiliated with David's group. I said to these members of Congress during a private meeting that we had, I said, this family, the Tsarnaev family, was not low-hanging fruit. You know that expression, low-hanging fruit? I said, what they are is fruit in the basket. Fruit in the basket. We know they're a threat. There's no doubt in anybody's mind that they are a problem. There's no doubt that they lied on their applications for asylum. And we did nothing. That is to say, the government did nothing. I still think we, as though I was still an agent. 30 years, it's a long time to develop that habit of saying we. Nothing was done to track her down, reel her in and find out what she was up to and possibly prosecute her for lying on her application for asylum, presuming that she applied for asylum. I mean, this is a level of ineptitude that blows the mind. Now, I want you to multiply that by the tens of thousands of refugees that are likely to be headed this way. We will have no idea who's here. ISIS has been given passports. They're using those passports issued to them in false names, dead people's names, because what ISIS has done, according to the news report, is overrun government facilities in Syria, seizing blank passports and the printing machines they use for those passports, and there are forgers out there that are cranking out a whole suite of documents, driver's license, passport, identity documents, and so forth. And believe it or not, lots of times refugees come to the United States without identity documents. They used to have a very big problem at Kennedy International Airport. For all I know, they still do. And what was the problem? You had people coming to the United States from the Middle East, and they would dispose of their passport on the airplane. They would eat them. They'd tear them up, flush them down the toilet. They'd get off the airplane and say, political asylum, where are you from? And they'd say, well, I'm from Afghanistan. They had no idea. They didn't know where they could have been from Mars. and they weren't taking them into custody. And you've got hearings going on in Washington right now where the open borders crowd, the immigration anarchists, are saying, oh, we shouldn't be arresting these people. Okay, so what did we do? We said, okay, political asylum, there you go. Here's your date. Show up at the immigration office in a month, in 3 weeks, in 8 weeks, in 3 months. Do you think they showed up? Do you think they showed up? Ramzi Youssef, one of the people involved with the bombing at the World Trade Center in 1993, came into Kennedy International Airport with a phony passport, said political asylum, and they let him go. They let him go. I mean, do you folks out there understand what is going on? We are begging for the next terrorist attack, and I'm not overstating the point. We had two terrorist attacks in 1993 at the World Trade Center, and a month before that at the CIA by an individual by the name of Kansi, a Pakistani national who applied for asylum. He shot up the CIA, killed two CIA officers, wounded three others, and fled the country. We brought him back, put him on trial, found him guilty. We executed him. The dead remain dead. The wounded remain wounded. We had the next attack. Finally, it was the Republicans who had me testify May 20th, 1997, about the threats posed by visa fraud, immigration fraud, 4.5 years before 9/11. And the Clinton administration did absolutely nothing. In fact, they implemented a program known as Citizenship USA, CUSA. You can look it up. Go to my website, go to michaelcutler.net, go to capsweb.org, go to Front Page Magazine. I write for all these things. Go to the social contract. I wrote a major article. It's 27 pages long. And then I just did an interview with the Glazov gang, which is part of the David Horowitz Freedom Center, about all these issues. So you have CUSA, where they ran over 1 million applications for U.S. citizenship through the process, and district directors, the head honchos of immigration offices around the country, were told, if you don't approve, not adjudicate, but approve your quota of applications, we will fire you. Because, you see, they're part of the senior executive service, so they could be fired. So they were intimidated because they could be fired. And by the way, Newt Gingrich was recently out there saying, we need to remove all civil service protections from those civil servants because they're all a lazy bunch of bums. And that way, when a new administration comes in, they can make sure they get rid of the people that aren't doing the job. No, what that would mean, Newt Gingrich, is that you will have a new administration come in and be in the position to intimidate people into doing what they want them to do. Think of the IRS scandal. Think of the IRS scandal. And it won't just be the people at the top who serve at the president's pleasure. It will be the people in the file room, every single worker. That was why the civil service system was developed. It wasn't developed to protect the workers for their benefit. It was done to protect the American people from corruption. People don't realize that. Because if you live in a political environment where when there is a new head honcho, whether it's the mayor of a town or the governor or the president, and they could go into a building of civil servants and tap them all on the shoulder, to use Christie's thing about tapping visa overstays on the shoulder, and say to them, you're going to approve every application or I'm firing you tomorrow. Or you're going to deny all these applications or I'm firing you tomorrow. Or you're going to arrest those people, even if there's no justification, or as we're now seeing with Obama, you're not going to arrest those people. A lot of people who are desperate for their job may make some bad choices. So the way that we protect ourselves from a government running amok is the civil service system. And I am sure that there are many of you who are sitting there listening to me right now saying, wow, I never thought of that. This is not about protecting civil servants. And yes, maybe the process for removing incompetent people is a little bit too drawn out. But you know what, folks? Let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater. Civil service protections were designed to protect the citizens, not the workers, because of the abuses of crooked politicians. And we all know we have seen far too many crooks from both the Democrat and the repugnant can parties, as I've come to call those two disgusting organizations. So don't be so quick. Don't be so quick. Civil service protections help to insulate us from the thievery of the crooked politicians. Forgive the redundancy. So in any event, my friend Lauren Martell, who's an attorney down in South Carolina, has issued a cease and desist letter on the politicians in South Carolina saying, you will not take these refugees until we get answers to our questions. The American people have the right to get their questions answered, and we're not getting answers, and we certainly don't get answers from this administration. The administration that promised to be the most transparent is the most opaque. They are as transparent as lead bricks, and the lies that were being spewed by the Labor Department, by the journalists, by the administration. We have a 5.1% unemployment rate. Never mind that 93 million working-age Americans either don't have jobs or are way underemployed from where they should be. Lunacy. But you know what was really disturbing to me was that CNN, for all of this effort with this debate, this ballyhoo debate, not a word about the asylum problem, not a word about the refugee crisis. Instead of all this back and forth and egging on a food fight, as far as I'm concerned, most of these journalists aren't much better from the kids that we dealt with back in junior high school when they started the fist fights in the schoolyard by antagonizing people. That's not what this is supposed to be about. It's not supposed to be about insults and mudslinging. It ought to be about a comparison of proposals and drilling down a bit, so that we know where people stand, so that we don't hear vague, I'm going to be a leader, I'm going to solve the problem. How? How? Jeb Bush talking about we can't afford to deport all these millions of people, we can't even build a fence, everything is too expensive. Why didn't anybody say to Jeb Bush, how is it too expensive? You see, because I will tell you something, ladies and gentlemen, and maybe I'm just nuts, but I am telling you that effective immigration law enforcement would not only not cost us a dime. I'm probably sounding like Donald Trump saying that he'll get the fence built and have Mexico pay for it. I'm telling you that effective immigration enforcement would yield us a net profit every year. We would make money off of it. Do I have your attention? I want you to think about this. Right now, the United States is losing probably over $200 billion in remittances, money wired home by foreign workers, both legal and illegal. The numbers used to be published by the World Bank and the United Nations. They were right there. When I started writing about this and going on TV and tried to talk about it, within months, the statistics came off the website. I kid you not. Is it because of me? Maybe, maybe not, but certainly an interesting coinkydink. Don't you think that that's a little coincidental? $200 billion a year, and I think it's way above that, because last year there were over $500 billion moving, $500 billion. And the United States traditionally accounts for more than half of the remittances that flow from the first world to the third world. That's the way the stats used to be. I check them every year. Over half of the money that flows from the first world to the third world comes out of the U.S. economy. There's something known as the multiplier effect. And that was the idea behind the economic stimulus package. If you put money into the economy, it stimulates the economy, and the economy grows. So let's say, for argument's sake, I write a report for an organization, or I do expert witness testimony at a trial, and I get a paycheck. And I take the paycheck, and I go out, and I buy a new suit, and I buy a pair of shoes. The salesman who sold me the clothing gets his paycheck because he gets paid commission on that sale. He buys a refrigerator. The salesman who sells him the refrigerator goes to the lumber yard and hires a carpenter, and he has a new deck put on his back porch. So that $1 suddenly generates three more dollars in business and commerce and grows the economy. The reverse happens. The reverse happens when you take money out of the economy. If you take a dollar out, you're really taking $3 or $4 out of the economy, because that's money that's lost forever. You may as well be burning it for all the good it's doing the economy. The annual growth in our national debt right now, from what I have read, is about $500 billion a year. The amount of remittances, when you look at the multiplier effect, more than makes up for the annual increase in America's national debt. So right there and then, we're winning. Now let's go beyond that. How many Americans are on unemployment, are getting food stamps, housing subsidies, have lost all their disposable income so they can no longer go out there and make purchases? Not because they're lazy. You know, I've heard columnists say, oh, all these people on long-term disability, these lazy people. That number doubled or tripled during the Obama administration. Do you think that many people woke up lazy all of a sudden? No, folks. They woke up unemployed. You look at all the people being fired in Silicon Valley. Disney just fired 500 American computer programmers and replaced them with people from India. And it wasn't that they did a bad job, because, in fact, Disney told those people, by the way, if you want your severance package, you're going to train your replacement. If you think they're doing a lousy job, you certainly wouldn't want them training their replacement. Let's be honest about it. So you take all these Americans, you suppress their wages, they go from being tax-paying, which helps our economy, consumers, which helps our economy, to people draining money off of the safety net programs, which hurts our economy, and they lose their disposable income, which further harms the economy. And then they lose their homes to foreclosure, so that depresses the value of homes, and that also has a negative impact on the U.S. economy. Then let's talk about the impact of crime. Let's talk about the impact of the children flooding our schools, which costs money to educate. There was a study done by the Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, about 5 or 10 years ago, and they said that to educate a child who is not fluent in the English language costs between, I believe it was 10 and 20% more than it costs to educate a child who comes to school fluent in the English language. It might even have been a higher number. I don't have the stats in front of me at the moment. It was at least 20%. It might have been more than that. So we're talking about a significant chunk of money being spent on educating the kids who are here illegally or who are born to parents who are here illegally. We're looking at the remittances. We're looking at the cost of crime. And if you want to talk about the open border that Mr. Bush says we just can't seal, just can't do it, understand that the real measure of border security is the heroin epidemic, and we're in the worst heroin epidemic ever. The demand for heroin has never been higher, which should mean that the price of heroin goes up. But because the supply is so plentiful, no matter how big the demand, the cost is going down, and we just can't, they just can't get a handle on it, because the poisons are pouring across our border, and not just the Mexican border. The drugs come in the container ships at seaport. They're coming in at international airports. We're being inundated with heroin, and that has a direct nexus to violent crime, and again, to more money being sent out of the country. If we tightened up our borders, if we went after the illegal criminal aliens, we would wind up with a net profit. And the easiest way to make the laws effective is to enforce them from within the interior of the United States. And then we add to it something called randomness, and it's something I plan to write about shortly. But this notion that we're only going to deport people who have serious criminal histories means that we've told ISIS and other terrorists that if you get to the United States, even illegally, as long as you don't get arrested by the police, America will ignore the fact that you violated the borders and the immigration laws. And that is the embedding tactic of choice. And you can go to the 9/11 Commission, and they talked flat out about the need to routinely enforce immigration laws from within the interior of the United States. And it's not just E-Verify, folks. E-Verify is good. I think we need to do that to make certain that we're not hiring illegal aliens. But beyond E-Verify, we need to have the willingness to arrest and deport aliens working illegally, not just the employer. We need to also make certain that aliens aren't getting green cards by getting married, for example, and not really living with their spouses, using that as a tactic, committing immigration fraud. And again, the 9/11 Commission made immigration fraud a major component in their findings. And what have we done to combat immigration fraud? And the answer is we have done less than nothing. The Dreamers, who could be as old as age 31, and most terrorists who carry out violent attacks are under the age of 30, the Dreamers who came here supposedly before they were 15, but they can be 31 years of age when they file their application, their applications now have a 97% approval rate. Almost none of their applications are being rejected or denied. Think about that. And we're talking about hundreds of thousands of illegal aliens whose identities can't be verified, who are not being interviewed in person, and who are not having field investigations conducted to verify that they didn't lie on their applications. November of last year, Newsweek ran a report, and it's part of the article that I wrote for Front Page Magazine about the refugee crisis, talking about how the CIA was completely, utterly, totally unable to vet the rebels in Syria so that they could have them assist us in fighting ISIS in the Middle East. If we can't vet a couple of thousand Syrians in the Middle East right there on the spot, you tell me what happens when the UN dictates who we're supposed to take into the country and we have no idea if their travel documents are counterfeit or not, or altered or not. If Jeb Bush wants to talk about immigration and an act of love, enforcing the immigration laws would be an act of love for Americans. It would be an act of love for American minority communities. It would be an act of love for the legal immigrants who play by the rules, follow the laws, and are made fools of because people that violate the law are treated so much better. Act of love. And this guy has the guts to stand there and make these statements. And I'm not sure what Ben Carson's story is. Maybe he needs to go to somebody for advice. I would like to see some politician stand up and say, I'm willing to bring on board with me a panel of agents and adjudicators, people who did the job, not the bosses, because those guys sold out. That's why they got the jobs. They went along with the program. They agreed to go along to get along. You know, I asked members of Congress. I think we're up to 16 congressional hearings. And I said to them, wow, I'm just a field agent. I was a senior special agent. I wasn't even a supervisor. And you want me to go before Congress? And they said to me, yes, Mr. Cutler, because you were the guy who got up every morning and went out and made the arrests and conducted the investigations and did the job. We know that the people in management got there because they agreed to go along with the program, you see, which was actually pretty smart. And the Republicans back then demonstrated incredible courage and integrity in the early part of the Bush administration, or actually through the Bush administration, because I did most of my hearings for them, although to give credit where it's due, Sheila Jackson Lee did call me for a couple of hearings. Of course, she's a super liberal Democrat from Texas. But mostly it was the Republicans, and they knew that I was going to go before those committees and subcommittees, and I was going to be very critical of President Bush, a president from their party. They were in control. And they said, yes, the president, if he's wrong, needs to know he's wrong, and the American people need to know he's wrong. And it blew me away. People like John Hostetler, who chaired the House Immigration Subcommittee and who lost his election bid. I actually campaigned for John because although he was a conservative Republican and I didn't agree with him on some issues, I certainly appreciated his integrity and courage. See, it's not about left or right. So back then, the Republican Party said, yes, we know you're going to come in and we know it's not going to be pretty for the president and he's probably going to get angry. And I was told he used to curse me out, George W., which is fine. I don't care. My neighbors died on 9/11. We're all at risk right now. I have kids. I have a granddaughter. I worry about their future. I worry about every child's future in our country. So please understand the point. They said to me, we want you to come in here and don't sugarcoat it. Call it the way you see it. We want the total truth. I don't know what's happened since then. I really don't. But we really need to understand that anybody who wants to be president should be looking, not winging it, not coming up with a brain spasm and saying, well, let's have them register. We're going to make sure they have a pristine record was the words that Dr. Carson used. What I think most people don't understand, unless you've done the job, is that running fingerprints very often doesn't yield any results. Because if you're dealing with people from third world countries or people that are war-torn, you're not going to get any results from that fingerprint check. It will only kick back if the person was in Europe or one of our allies or here in the United States. But if you have somebody who's never been arrested in the United States, the odds are quite good that you take the fingerprint, it's going to come back no record. And if they use a fake name, the fake name comes back no record. And I made that argument to Congressman Jim Sensenbrenner when he was chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, and he was supporting then-President Bush's program for a guest worker program. And within 1 week, he did a 180 and came to agree with me. I think the real solution here is, do we have any candidates who were, and it doesn't have to be me, I'd certainly volunteer in a New York second to advise anybody running for the presidency to let them know what the landscape truly looks like. But if you don't want me, that's great. But go to people who really understand the issue and use them for advice instead of shooting from the hip. I don't expect these people to have the information, but a good leader doesn't know everything, but a good leader knows where to go to get the information that he or she needs to be effective in the job. That's what a leader is. The band leader doesn't play every instrument, but he has to know how to make that orchestra work in unison. That's what's lacking. It's time to stop shooting from the hip. It's time to stop these little food fights and looking for key words. And you know, the one point that I didn't really get to, but again, for those people that are in Spartanburg, South Carolina, I hope that you come out on Sunday night at 6:30, because this is an important event. But do you know that right now we have the greatest number of foreign students in the United States, primarily from Asia, studying STEM courses, science, technology, engineering, math? How in the world, ladies and gentlemen, does this help Americans? Even as we look at China and other countries that are developing their own military, how many of the engineers that are helping to build the nuclear navy for China were educated in the United States? How many of their scientists and engineers that have developed their space program that enables them to now reach into orbit and shoot down presumably our satellites or other satellites, how many of those people were trained in the United States? We have an obligation first and foremost to America and Americans. And bringing in hundreds of thousands of students to teach them the programming courses, you know, computer programming and engineering and math, the STEM curriculum, when Americans can't find work, and then you have politicians saying, and once they come here and we educate them, we should give them green cards. No, we should not, and we should not be educating them, folks. We have how many millions of unemployed and underemployed Americans? Those classrooms should be filled with Americans. We hear from the other side that we need America to lead. It's not going to be solved by bringing in the best and brightest from around the world. If you truly believe in American exceptionalism, do you know what the word is to describe the world's best and brightest, folks? We describe the world's best and brightest with one word, Americans. If you go to town hall meetings, and I hope you will, and someone stands up and says, we're going to bring in the best and brightest, stand up and just say two words, citizens first. Let's put Americans back to work. Let's put America's concerns about national security and public safety at the head of the list. And let's stop the nonsense. You know, I always like to make the point that democracy is not a spectator sport. That has never been more true than it is today. Thank you so much for joining me. I hope you'll be here with me again next week at the very same time on the Michael Cutler Hour. And please, folks, remember, democracy is not a spectator sport. Have a great weekend. And to my Jewish friends out there, my neighbors, I'm Jewish as well, happy, healthy, safe, and peaceful New Year to everybody. Be well.